Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hi, this is Todd.
And this is Kim.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism. To me, humanism is a philosophy, a way of living with humans as the center of it. We are in control. We make our choices, whether they're good or bad. We live with the consequences and hopefully learn from them and make better ones the next time.
That was a good definition. And speaking of philosophy, this month's guest is actually a philosopher. We have A.C. Grayling on the show, who we'll get to in a little bit, but he is a wizard of philosophy and way over my head on many of these issues, but he has a new book out about humanism, so that should be pretty interesting. So listeners, I should introduce you to Kim. Kim Ellington is our guest co-host for the month. Kim's a good friend of mine from here in Raleigh. And she is a member of the board of directors of the Triangle Freethought Society. She is also a new lobbyist for the Secular Coalition for America for North Carolina. So I guess that's SCNC.
Yes.
She is a mother and is also a board member for Camp Quest South Carolina. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you very much. That's a pretty fun bio. I feel very important right now. It won't last, so I'm going to enjoy it for a few minutes.
Yeah, I'll begin insulting you at any moment, I'm sure.
Excellent. Keep me in line.
It's part of my job. So tell me a little bit about this lobbying you've been doing.
It has gotten to a point, if anybody Googles North Carolina General Assembly right now, they are going to see that there is a steady stream of religious-based idiocy, is the nicest way I can say it right now, that is flowing from our legislative building. We have control of people who feel like, or apparently, or actually don't feel like it. They are convinced that Christianity is the only religion and that they have an obligation to subject the rest of us to it. Well, I decided that I was going to do something about it. And we have a wonderful man named Joe Donovan who takes care of the Secular Coalition for North Carolina. And he invited me to come to a lobby day with him to start learning the process of explaining gently and firmly and persistently to our state senators and state representatives that not everybody is Christian, nor should Christianity be the basis for laws that come out of our theoretically secular state government.
You're talking crazy now.
I know. That's probably what they thought too. It was a little bit daunting being there at first, because of knowing that there's people that think that all around you. Like, I was completely surrounded. You know, one of the decisions that just came out this week, the House has passed a resolution 104-0 to institute a national week of prayer in North Carolina. Now, that was 16 people either abstained or were absent, but 104-0, those people were all around me.
And how did they receive you?
Well, we did, I don't know how many actual congresspeople I got to talk to. We did not go door to door this time. For the lobby day, we did some tabling and I pretty much accosted anybody walking by.
Wait a minute. Breaks.
Verbally.
There was no violence.
No violence. No, I actually attacked with smiles. You know, my point to being there is that atheists and humanists, we're just like everybody else. We're pretty smiley and happy, and we just want to get our point across and remind everybody that there's other ways to live.
Listeners, the Secular Coalition for America is a organization that represents us in Washington, D.C., and now rolling out across the country. They are working on establishing local groups specifically for lobbying in all 50 states, and that program is well on its way. And as you could hear, it's already available here in North Carolina. So be sure to check out secular.org and learn more about it. Sign up for the action alerts and join in the fun in your local state. So you're also working locally doing some work for National Day of Reason, I believe.
Yeah, the National Day of Reason is coming up May 2nd, I think. What used to happen is that the National Day of Prayer people actually had a vigil or whatever they call it on the State House grounds. So what the Triangle Freethought Society did was secure the State House grounds on that day so that we could physically put a block between state and church. So the churches had, they were relegated to a different area and off of our Capitol grounds. So yeah, that's been a, that was a lovely moment. This
keeping
year,
church and state separate by occupying their space.
Yes. That's exactly what we did. And as you know, because you were there too, and one of our wonderful, very fired up, passionate speakers about the separation of church and state, it was very successful. So, this year we're not claiming victory yet, but there are no National Day of Prayer events scheduled in the Raleigh area that aren't in churches. And of course, if they want to have them in churches, that's their business.
That's awesome. Go for it.
Yeah. So I'm excited. I'm excited. Now, unfortunately, we have this House bill that got passed about the National Week of Prayer. So we're going to have to, that just happened. So we are working right now on creating a new event to protest that idiocy.
Yeah. It's interesting, listeners. Kim and I happen to live in this area, but North Carolina has been making national news recently for the bumbling idiocy of our legislature. Unfortunately, this particular week of prayer bill is not a very good one, of course, but fortunately we dodged a bullet when the religious right actually kind of showed their hand and what they really are about, what they really want. They actually had the gall to propose a law which had 11 co-signers, including the General Assembly Majority Leader, to establish an official state religion for North Carolina. Like, literally, we are going to become a Christian state. Well, this is what we've known all along the religious right has wanted. This is what a lot of these little laws are about. They want a week of prayer. This is not about a week of Islamic prayer. This is a week of specifically sectarian Christian prayer is what they're hoping for. And they really showed what they're all about by proposing this law. Now, there was a lot of backlash and it got rejected and didn't go very far, but it's kind of scary when you see this come out. And then afterwards, there was actually a study done nationally and they found that almost a half of Republicans in this country would favor a constitutional amendment establishing Christianity as the official religion of the country. And there was a whole ton of Democrats that supported it too. Yeah. So, you know, neither party is innocent here. This is a really scary thing with nearly a third of the country supporting such an amendment to essentially say everyone who's a religious minority is going to be subjugated. We're going to give special privileging to one faith. And then, of course, the argument will become, well, Christianity isn't really just one religion. It's a whole lot of different religions. So which one? Is it Catholicism? Is it Baptist? Are we going to be one nation under Seventh-day Adventists? I don't know. So, so in other interesting news, a little follow-up from last month, we'd covered the clergy project, and there was actually recently a Washington Post article about one of the groups we talked about last month. Kim, are you familiar with the Houston Oasis?
I am. Isn't that the group that is like, it's a free thought church in that area, right?
Essentially, yeah, that would be one way to describe it. I think they've been trying to dodge the word church, but what it is Mike Ouse, who is a member of the clergy project, eventually came out last year, I believe, at the American Atheist Convention and said that he's an atheist. And in turn, this led to him not leading his church anymore. And he ended up founding this group, Houston Oasis, which is a Sunday service, which there's many of these popping up around the country and around the world. The Sunday Assembly is becoming popular in London and is expanding elsewhere. And so, yeah, he's created this Houston Oasis and it's becoming pretty popular already. They've got music, a lot of fun activities and talks. And you know, in some ways it might be reminiscent of some of the things that churches do. But from what I've read, they're doing the things that are good about church and they're dropping the dogma and authority and the scary stuff that's not good about church.
That is pretty interesting. I think that would be fun. I never went to church. I did like once or twice when I was a kid, but so it's interesting to me to see what it is that people like about it. And then it would be even more interesting for me to see people like myself, what they have decided is the important parts of church. That would be an interesting study for me.
In this particular case, I think one of the most interesting things that happened is apparently several of the leaders of the church that the Christian church Mike belonged to actually left the church and went with him. They liked working with him and liked him as a leader. They moved along with him and followed him to the next non-church, I guess, to the next oasis.
We had Jerry DeWitt speak to us, as I know a lot of groups around the country have, and he is definitely a dynamic speaker, and it's fun. It is fun to listen to people that get passionate and riled up. In fact, Todd, somebody posted on my Facebook an Upworthy of part of your speech at Rock Beyond Belief, and somebody had said that it was very pastor-like and fired up. And I said, that's wonderful. But the fact of the matter is anybody who is passionate about anything and fired up and talking, I will listen to it because there's got to be something behind it. Even the crazy person on the street who's fired up about, you know, the ants that are going to take over our brains, I'll stop and listen for a minute.
Are they really?
Well, according to that guy that had the big sign over on Fayetteville Street last week, yes.
I knew it. Mm-hmm. I've been waiting for confirmation for, a long time. It's only the red ants, though.
I think you're right. well, good for them down in Houston. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic because personally, I'm not one of those people who thinks religion is all evil. I think that religion definitely has a lot of negative aspects to it, but I don't have a big problem with music, and music is an integral part of many church services. So is music bad just because it's part of the service? Maybe it is if it's, you know, inspiring people to hate other people or become xenocentric, but music in general is a beautiful, wonderful thing. And that's one example right there of something that could be a positive thing. And frankly, pastors are really good inspirational speakers. They are good at it. I might not agree with the beliefs they associate with that passion, but if the rhetorical skills of a pastor could be moved over into espousing humanism, I'm all for it.
I think you're absolutely right. I love reading inspirational quotes and things like that. And if we got TED Talks, to me, are very inspirational. So if a humanist service or a non-religious Sunday assembly speech has, you know, teaches me something and gives me something to go on for the week and makes my heart happy. Well, we know it's my brain, not my heart, but I do have a physical reaction to my happiness that makes my heart feel lifted. Hey, I'm all for that. I love it.
So are you excited about our guest this month?
I am. I am very excited about our guest this month. The first interview I heard with him was the one he did on Colbert Nation, and I almost wet my pants. It was hysterical. I think Stephen Colbert came out and said that he had an author who's written another one of those books that praises humanism. Talk about pandering to your audience. And that just started it off perfectly. I loved it. I read his new book, The God Argument, which is the case against religion and for humanism. And I really, really liked it. We were just talking earlier about how I'm just kind of getting into philosophy, and to read someone who is well versed on the subject and writes very, very clearly, I enjoyed chewing over the sentences and having to think about what it was that he was saying and comparing what he was saying to my experience. A.C. Grayling is a professor of philosophy and master of the New College of the Humanities in London. He has written and edited over 30 books on philosophy and other subjects. Among his most recent are The Good Book, Ideas That Matter, Liberty in the Age of Terror, and To Set Prometheus Free. He wrote for several years the Last Word column for the Guardian newspaper and a column for the Times. And he is a frequent contributor to the Literary Review, the Independent on Sunday, and the Times Literary Supplement.
Professor A.C. Grayling, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Should we call you A.C., Anthony, or do you prefer Cliff?
Anthony is the normal name, but you can call me anything you like, providing it's not too rude.
Fair enough. The same goes for me. You can call me whatever you'd like.
Me as well.
And I don't mind if you call me something rude. It's all right.
We generally do. We call him rude things all the time, but that's another story.
Just shows you how open we humanists are to a little bit of humor in life.
Indeed. So you have a new book out called The God Argument, The Case Against Religion and for Humanism. I was wondering if you'd tell our listeners a little bit about the book.
Yes, indeed. Well, as the subtitle suggests, it's a book in two halves. And the first half considers the kinds of reasons that somebody might have for not holding a religious commitment. I put it that way because sometimes people think that when you write a book on a religious topic and you're not yourself a religious person, that what you're trying to do is to convert others to your view or to change their minds. And naturally enough, if one were to change minds, that would be a good thing. But Jonathan Swift, a long time ago, said it's very hard to reason people out of views that they weren't reasoned into. So a much better tack, really, is to explain why it is that one doesn't find the kinds of considerations that motivate other people to have religious outlooks, why they don't persuade oneself. So all the different things that one thinks about in thinking about religion considered in general terms in the first half of the book by way of saying, this is why I don't agree or I'm not persuaded by these views. I think it's important to do this at the moment because for more than a decade now, there's been quite a bad-tempered argument between people who do have a religious commitment and those who don't. And it's time, I think, to step back a couple of paces and to say exactly what is at stake in this discussion. And one thing I wanted to do was to distinguish with people the three separable strands. I say separable because, of course, there is a natural connection between them, but they can be and should be distinguished. One is the theism-atheism discussion. The second is the secularism discussion. And the third is the question of the basis of our moral lives. Now, the first is a metaphysical issue about what there is, what kind of place the universe is. The second is about the place and the amplification of the religious voice in the public square, influencing public policy and education and the progress of science. And the third is what I think interests us as humanists, which is to talk a little bit about the kind of basis we might have for trying to build good and worthwhile lives.
I loved reading this book. One of my favorite quotes in the beginning, in the against religion part, was when you were talking about, it's like a belief football, I think is how you put it.
Belief I'm sure football. You meant belief American football, right?
No, soccer.
Oh, duh.
I think you said that what's really happening is that they're trying to vie for our allegiance, all the different types of religion, and we're actually not even on the field. We're actually
That's
sitting
correct.
In the stands arguing that we shouldn't even be playing the game, and I thought that was fantastic.
That is correct, because of course the very word atheism is a theist's word to describe people who don't share their views. It's a bit like not thinking that astrology speaks to us about our destinies and characters. You're just not in that debate at all. So you didn't think about the world in those terms. Don't approach matters in that light. And that's why it's not necessary to understand the different schools of thought in astrology. Because if you've attacked the root, that is, if you've said to yourself, well, the stars and planets visible from the planet Earth 3,000 years ago don't provide any basis for thinking about how our lives might unfold, then you don't get involved in the minutiae of it. And I think that's pretty well the position of the atheist, who therefore turns his or her attention to other considerations like, well, what sense are we to make about the great variety of religions and the impact they have on individual lives and societies? And what are we to think about this question of our responsibilities towards one another, our relationships, and how we organize societies so that individuals in them really can make the best of their lives and get satisfaction and achievement out of them, especially in their relationships with others.
You're talking about the separation of humanism, secularism, and theism. Do you see theism, or rather, I guess, atheism and secularism as also part of humanism, or only completely separate from?
Oh, no, they certainly can be. I said at the outset there that I used the word separable, that is, that they can be separate from one another, because, of course, there can be religious folk who are secularists. Indeed, secularism originated in medieval times in the desire of the church itself not to have the temporal powers interfering in its business. Secularism was originally a religious movement. Of course, the church didn't want to have the temporal powers interfering with it, although it was perfectly happy to interfere with the temporal powers, so it was an asymmetric kind of secularism. But the idea began with them. And nowadays, there are some people of religion who think that church and state, religion and public policy, religion and education, that these things should be kept separate. My point, I suppose, is that if you are an atheist, you're, of course, very likely to be a secularist. And if you're both those things, then, of course, when you begin to think about ethics, you're likely to be, in the small h sense, at very least, a humanist. That is, somebody who thinks that our ethical outlook has to be premised on our best understanding of human experience.
I like that. I like that very much. I think it might have been on the back of your book, but the saying that we are the most sympathetic understanding of human nature and the human condition, and I thought that is something that I would be proud to say of myself. That is definitely something worth working towards.
Well, it is a very, sort of apart from the fact that at the most reductive level, all we have is the lives we have between birth and death. What's significant about us as social beings is the need that we have for one another, for those relationships I mentioned, and in particular how we're to construct good societies within which individuals can flourish. So the demand on us to try to be as sympathetic and as generous as we can be in making sense of what it is to be human is the originating demand for thinking about ethics. An important point here, of course, is that we have to recognize that although there are many, many things that human beings share in common with one another, which is why we're able to have systems of law and regimes of human rights, because very few of us like to be cold or lonely or without friends or tortured or hungry. Nevertheless, we're also very diverse, and it's this recognition that each individual requires some space around him or her so that, there is a chance of working out what the values are, what the meaning is in one's individual existence. In order to do that, we have to allow other people that space. And the quickest way of explaining it is to remember what George Bernard Shaw said about the Golden Rule. Golden Rule is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And he said, under no circumstances should you do to others what you'd like them to do to you, because they may not like it. And it's a very important point. We can't each of us think that we're the standard or the benchmark for what tastes, interests, and desires other people have. We have to allow them to make those choices. Of course, within negotiated limits about the parameters of communal living, but in a way that really does allow people to make meaning in their lives, because that's where meaning comes from.
It sounds like you do not subscribe to the Golden Rule then necessarily. Is that true? And if so, what would you say is a good quick summary of premium ethics, if you will, the best of ethics?
Well, I think the best of ethics is a demand on people to think and to choose to live the considered life, a life in which consideration of one's own talents and capacities for doing something worthwhile, consideration of what we owe to others in the way of kindness and generosity, and of what we owe to ourselves and others in building good communities so that we can all benefit from what we share in those communities. Those, I think, are the sort of founding principles, in a way, that guide us. Because they do leave open this, I think, very important point that I've just been alluding to, which is that given the diversity of human nature, what would be a way of life, a set of choices that make your life very flourishing and make you a good neighbor to your fellow human beings, might be different from mine. I mean, they'll certainly share some things in common. We will agree, for example, things like murder and theft and robbery and selfishness and what have you are destructive of human relationships. So we will have those as our parameters. But each of us might think and feel in ways that are very individual to ourselves. And so this idea of a degree of autonomy, which has as the reverse, if you like, a responsibility, a demand on us to think and act and to take responsibility for our moral activities, that's very important.
I like that, a demand on our moral selves. And it was interesting, one of the things that caught me was when you were talking about how we don't need superstition to get in the way of the fact that there's still a lot that humanists and atheists and I guess other, skeptical free thought type people, there's plenty of things that we don't agree on that we still need to work on. And that was an interesting piece to me because I hadn't thought about it like that before. You said, I think it was like differences of opinion on how to distribute societal goods and in questions of natural justice.
Yes, this is an important point, that there's still lots of room and indeed lots of need for us to discuss how we're going to organize ourselves in society. And this is where politics comes into it. The fact that somebody is an atheist or a humanist doesn't entail what their politics is going to be, for the very good reason that unlike any kind of totalizing ideology, and you know, the great religions are in their fullest historical form, are perfect examples of such ideologies, because they are one size fits all, top down. They've got the truth, the one great truth, the one right way to live, and everybody has to toe the line on that. And if you don't, you're a heretic or a dissident, and you may very well be punished as a result. And by the way, it's not only the great religions in their fullest historical form, but the great totalizing political ideologies like Stalinism or Maoism, which say the same thing. They say, we've got the answer. We know the right way to live. Everybody's got to agree. And if you don't, you're in danger of punishment. Now, we contrast to that the idea of the open society, the kind of society in which lots of different choices can be made, lots of different experiments in living can be permitted, again, within those broad parameters about not doing harm to others. This is John Stuart Mill, that lovely essay by him called On Liberty. He says, it's so important that different sorts of lives and different kinds of experiments in living ought to be permissible, because then the chances of finding ways in which human beings can really flourish are so much greater. And when he wrote that essay, he wasn't worried so much about political illiberalism. He was worried about the tyranny of social opinion, you know, moralism, the fact that there is a kind of one rule for everybody sort of view.
It's interesting you say that, because I've been trying to figure out a good way to articulate a concept like that, which you seem to do vastly easier than I'm able to. It's this concept of where societies go astray. What is in common between Nazism, Stalinism, fundamentalist Islam, crusaders? Perhaps it is this kind of totalistic ideology that encompasses everything and demands superiority in all aspects of life, whether it be government, ethical, etc., and doesn't tolerate any others. Is that kind of what you're saying here?
Yes, and you can see why there might be motivation to do that. I mean, supposing you sincerely believe that to believe Proposition X is necessary for the salvation of your soul, if you don't believe it, or if you don't obey the injunction it contains, then you might be condemned to eternal torment. Just supposing you believe that. Well, then you might be very anxious for your fellow human beings if they don't believe it along with you. You might want to save them. And if saving them meant doing it at the point of the sword, or launching a crusade on them, or killing them now before they've accumulated too many more sins, which was the justification for burning people at the stake, then you would go ahead and do it. And you would do it with a very clear conscience, because you would think that you were doing them a favor. And so this idea of owning the truth, you know the great truth that everybody should understand, and if they don't, they've got to be forced to understand it, gives you a kind of license to impose it on others. Typically, in religions, you have what's sometimes known in philosophy as divine command moralities. There's a nice way of putting it by saying, well, you know, there is a God, and this God loves us, and so we must respond by obeying. And there is a less nice way, which says we are the creatures, the creatures. We're created by God, so we have to obey. You know, we belong to him or her. But that kind of idea, the idea implicit in all the major religions that we are the possession, the servitors, the creatures of another agency interested in our obedience to it. Remember what the word Islam means, submission. In Christianity, we pray, not my will be done, but thy will be done. Great. Sin in Christianity is pride, meaning you can do it for yourself or think for yourself. The first sin in the Garden of Eden was the sin of disobedience. In fact, sin means disobedience. So in divine command morality, you've got to stop thinking. You must obey. You must submit your will. You must give over yourself to something else, the direction of another agency. And in the humanist, secularist, atheist view of things, the responsibility is our own. You know, we have to stand up and take responsibility for ourselves and think about how we're going to live. Thinking's hard. Thinking about that is quite a challenge, but it is distinctively the human challenge to think about what we're to do and about our relationships with others. And of course, as soon as we do begin to think, we begin to see quite clearly what some of those very, very important things are. When we think about what a human being really needs to flourish, like the opportunity to give and receive affection, to have friendships, have opportunities to expand one's abilities, to learn more, to understand something about the world, to be a maker, a doer, because we're very creative primates, you know. All those things come to be clear, obvious, central aspects of what a good life would be once one sees clearly that it's not a matter of obedience and waiting for posthumous reward.
You know, that's interesting that you mentioned that. This morning, somebody had put on my door a flyer for me to join Friendship Baptist, was actually the name of the church. And I opened up the flyer, and the first three things they talked about for this new birth they're trying to push, the first three things were absolutely anti-human to me. The first was that you have to admit you're a sinner. And I thought, well, that's just horrible. And then the next was you have to understand that you have no power over it. I know a lot about human nature. I'm certainly not a professional. I'm not a psychologist, but I don't understand how people find solace in that kind of mentality because there's no power in it. There's none at all.
I know it's quite the opposite, isn't it, of attributing to people the capacity to do something which makes life good or merely bearable or which contributes to the goodness of other people's lives. What you've just identified there is this premise which says we're born diseased and we need a doctor. All our problems are the result of the fact that we have this failing and we're in need of salvation, we're in need of being saved. And so we have to go and submit ourselves, our wills, our minds, our power of thought to something else, and then we'll be okay. Now, the attraction of that, the psychological attraction of it, is easy enough to see. One can see it directly, but one also sees it indirectly when one remembers, you know, how it is that we think of the past as a kinder place where the grass was greener and the summers were longer. And of course, it was, because we were children then and we didn't have to pay taxes or go to work in the morning. So naturally enough, we do think the past was kinder and nicer. And some of the things we associate with the past, like the religious beliefs that people might have tried to inculcate in us when we were small, look like resources of comfort and solace in a world which can sometimes be very dark and very cruel. The religions survive because they know they have to get these beliefs into small children's heads. And even if they lose those children, you know, when people get to the courting age, in fact, you know, when the sort of horny period of life when religion is a bit of a nuisance because you want to have girlfriends and boyfriends and so on. But if disaster, grief, failure, depression occur later on, people are quite likely to recur to the religion of their childhood. And this is something that religious psychology well understands. Get those seeds into the head of small, intellectually defenseless children who can't evaluate what they're being told. And they may very well sprout later on in life and keep the loyalty of people.
There's been a large number of books on new atheism and even humanism over the last decade or so in particular. When you struck out to write this book, what did you want to do to make it different from all the other books that were out there?
Well, I took it, and I'm here talking about people I'm personally acquainted with and count as friends, Sam Harris and Dan Dennett, Richard Dawkins. In fact, in the case of Dan Dennett, Stephen Pinker, and Richard Hawkins, I employ them all. You know, they're all visiting professors at my college, so I'm their employer as well as their acquaintance of theirs. And then, of course, the late lamented Hitch. All of them approached the matter in a particular way. Hitch used to describe himself as an anti-theist as well as an atheist. That is, he was opposed to theists who wanted to impose their views on others or coerce others or terrorize them or kill them because they didn't agree with them. So he was emphatic and robust and frank in his criticism of theism and of religion and of its effects, its very deleterious effects on society. Richard Dawkins explain, naturally annoyed after many decades of trying to explain to people the principles of evolution in biology, still to be encountering six-day creationists. And you can imagine why you might get rather abrupt with them after all that time. As it happens, when I was in the States a couple of weeks ago, I went to the Creation Museum in Kentucky. I have to say, it's a flabbergasting experience, and this is something that Richard Dawkins has to put up with all the time, because as somebody trying to explain science and the principles of biological science in particular, is constantly irritated, really, and there's a chronic irritation to find how ignorant people are and how little they understand about these things. Dan wanted to try to understand the psychology of belief and to talk about why it is that people might think in these sorts of terms. So each of them are coming at the matter from a slightly different angle. What I wanted to do was to try to give a sort of conspectus view, to stand back a bit from the particular arguments and put them into a context. For example, most debates about the existence of God or about the validity of religious thinking or the plausibility of it use the word God with a capital G as if it were a name and as if they were a subject matter that was worth talking about. And to try to illustrate the problem here, I sometimes say to people who want to debate religion with me, I say to them, what I would be very happy to do is to debate the existence of fairies with you. Now, this is not a flippant remark, because it happened that right up until the end of the 19th century, even into the early 20th century, many people, especially in the UK here, quite sincerely believed that there were fairies, little people who, you know, were a bit of a nuisance. They curdled the milk, they stole your shoelaces when you weren't looking, they pinched you, they gave you the egg in bed at night, you know, that kind of thing. They were perfectly serious about it. I mean, they believed in these things much more than they did in the deity, who only existed on Sundays. But the fairies were there all week round, and they were a real pest. And in fact, the Church of England in England set up elementary schools in order to combat superstition about fairies. There's an irony for you. So I have an interest in debating the existence of fairies with people, because very few people believe in them now, even though 100 years ago people were taking photographs of them, you remember, and there were books about them and so on. So I say, let's discuss the existence of fairies. I want to ask you, do you think there are fairies at the bottom of your garden? If the person says no, I ask them for their reasons why they think that there aren't any. And then I say, every reason you've mentioned can be exported to the question of whether there are gods and goddesses, in any number, including the number one. And then they see the point. They see what it is that you're doing in the case where, for historical and traditional reasons, and because there are church spires in every town and mosques and synagogues and so on, you know, men, usually men, in funny dresses, officiating in these buildings, that just because that's the case, it doesn't make the intellectual plausibility of what's being believed or said any greater than the fairy case. So I wanted to illustrate this. I wanted to get back from the nature of the debate about Islam or about Christianity specifically. And I wanted to put it into context. I wanted to show something about the historical and psychological reasons, about the sorts of semantic and logical mistakes that have already have to have been made in order to start a discussion about the existence of gods or the plausibility of religions.
The second half of the book is the argument for humanism. What, in brief summary, leaving enough out there so the listeners want to go by and read it, of course, what is your kind of the high-level view of what the argument for humanism is?
Well, I think fundamentally, humanism is not a doctrine. It's not a set of prescriptions or instructions about how to live. Rather, it's an attitude. And the attitude we've described already is we have to think for ourselves, we've got to take responsibility for ourselves, and in taking that responsibility, we have to think how to relate to care for, to be good neighbors to our fellows in the human story. And that means that we've got to be really open in our thinking and our attitude towards them, accepting and tolerant, generous really is the word, generous and kind. But we have to recognize that mostly human beings do get on wonderfully with one another, that's the majority story of human experience, is that we are polite and helpful and cooperative and courteous towards one another. The reason why atrocity, murder, mayhem, terrorism, conflict is in the newspapers is because all those things are news. They're the minority aspect of human experience, and they do frighten us, trouble us, because they are so disruptive. But you have only to look around a street in any town or city, and you see the fruits of cooperation, of planning, of peacefulness, of people keeping their end of a bargain. You know, the lights come on at night, the sewage system works, the buses run, the airplanes are more or less on time. This is all the result of the enormous network of relationships that human beings establish with one another. And it's along those pulses, really, that we can continue to live in ways that are constructive for ourselves as well as for our neighbors. So this is this idea, the idea of the generous and sympathetic view of human nature and the human condition. Now, of course, literature, philosophy, history, the social sciences explore and examine the human condition and provide us with many, many insights, a great deal of opportunity for understanding the difficulties that we face and the possibilities and joys that we have as human beings. Understanding human nature is a much more complex thing, of course, and we all of us spend lifetimes trying to understand ourselves, let alone those we care about, and very rarely do we succeed. But it is part of the good life to try, you know, the good and well-lived life, that is, to try to achieve some self-understanding and to understand those we care about. The work of being human is the work of understanding humanity and of trying to do something that potentiates the best in ourselves and in others. It's a little bit like interviewing somebody, you know, when you're interviewing somebody for a job. The wise interviewer tries to so arrange things that he or she can see this person, the interviewee, in the best light, you know, rather than challenging them and tackling them and setting them a very, very difficult task. You give them an opportunity to be their best so that you can see what they're really like and what they have to offer. It's like Emerson said, we should do to human beings what we do to a painting, which is to put it in the best light.
One of the things that we were talking about earlier is the, I can't say proliferation because that's a word that implies something bigger, but there's been several stories about different places that have kind of atheistic Sunday services, which are rather humanistic. And I think the Harvard Humanist Center is trying to do that as well. Do you have thoughts on that?
There have been in the past efforts to have non-religious church-like organizations. Back in the 19th century, the positivist movement started by Auguste Comte, for example, attempted to mimic some of the forms and structures of a religion without being one, religion without God. And there is a certain, you know, tendency, as you say, for this now. Getting together with like-minded people is always an important thing. I don't know just how these sorts of endeavors sustain themselves when they too closely follow the lineaments of something they're trying not to be. What I would rather see is people reclaiming and redescribing as what in a secular sense of spiritual you might call the spiritual, that is the complex of our emotional, intellectual responses to others and to the world, and then to reclaim for that the simple things like going for a walk in the country or going to a concert, listening to music, looking at art, reading. Best of all, though, being with friends, having dinner with friends or going for a walk with a friend. But those sorts of things are what refresh the inner human and provide us with some of those solaces, some of those comforts and inspirations that we need. And it would be much better if the whole world were our church and life itself were our worship, you know, if you were going to have any kind of analogy, rather than to try to do a bit of mimicry. But I'm not against it. I don't mind it. It may be that there are people who need to do it, and that's fine. I think part of the difficulty has always been that atheists and humanists and secularists have tended, on the whole, to be non-joiners. It's not always attractive to people who have independent ways of thinking about things to club together, you know, to go to a sort of AA for the non-believer, if you like. It may not be to everybody's taste. And if it isn't, then they don't need to, because they should be able to find the mere existence of our fellowship. I mean, we're all of us talking together now, humanists, and so there is this great fellowship of humanists, millions and millions of us all around the world. And when occasionally we meet, it's very satisfying, but we don't always need to do it unless that's our thing.
I found what you said there very refreshing, because you said it's okay and it's fine with you for the people who do feel they need that kind of community or maybe a Sunday service or the like to do such things. One thing I've noticed that sometimes within humanism and atheism, there are people who view what we do as having only one right way, kind of going to one of the key falls of religion. And I've heard people specifically talk about Sunday services and the like as, oh, no, we should never do that. That's too much like church. That's the wrong way to do it, and start kind of publicly criticizing and attacking. And at least to me, that's somewhat counterproductive. And so I think it's great to have someone on the show with a voice that is recognizes that there's not just one right way and is understanding of the other sides.
Yeah, I think we must, in recognition of that diversity point I was mentioning earlier, we have to acknowledge actually and indeed encourage lots of different experiments in ways that people do these things, because some resources will provide some kinds of satisfaction, others. And yes, indeed, we must allow that. I mean, I think it's tolerance is a great virtue here.
You point out in your book that many people are already humanists and don't know it. How do we help people learn that they really are a humanist?
I suppose by the model provided us by the lesbian, gay, bi, and transgender community is a very good one here, the out and proud example. When people acknowledge their standpoint in life, it allows other people who actually share it, but who are a little bit apprehensive perhaps or hesitant about expressing it or about behaving differently. I mean, I've met so many people who go to church every Sunday with the family. They don't want to, upset the family or upset the mother or the grandmother. So they do it, and they don't really feel comfortable about it, and it's inconsistent with how they, feel. And then they see that there are other people out there, perfectly nice people, perfectly respectable people who are trying to live honestly and so on. And then it gives them a kind of an empowerment, and they feel that they can do it likewise. So there are lots of people who believe they believe or think they believe or who don't really believe but who don't, face up to it. Or there are a lot of people whose attitudes are extremely similar to ours. The only way that they can really be helped is to be given the example and the opportunity. And if we do that, we will find the numbers grow. And the numbers will go to a point, a sort of tipping point, really, where there will be a cascade effect, where a lot of people, with a great sigh of relief, will be able to say, oh, I've got the whole of Sunday to myself at last. or there are people out there who don't think these silly things. And then they feel liberated by it. And I've actually met and talked to such people. I've actually had the experience of people coming up to me after a talk and saying, oh, I've sort of discovered this way of thinking about things, or I've discovered that other people think similarly, that I'm not alone, I'm not mad, and what a liberation this is. And that's exactly what it is. Now, indeed, I'm a little inclined to think about this as a human rights thing, the liberation of the mind from the trammels of an indoctrination almost always in childhood, imprisoned in a way of thinking about the world which is painful to leave or difficult to leave, made to feel that if you turn your back on your community or on your tradition, that you are a betrayer of it in some way. And when people do finally shake it off and leave, it's so often the case, they feel as if they can breathe, that it really is like being out in the sunshine and the fresh air at last.
Were you raised with religion?
No, I wasn't. I was very fortunate, in a way, to be brought up in an entirely religious-free zone. There was no mention of it, no discussion of it, apart from curses, there were, sort of cursing invocations of the deity, but I didn't really know what it meant, it just sounded, cathartic. Yes. And when I got to school and found that there were these various people who had these different beliefs, I was very astonished by them. I mean, it was quite interesting, in a way, that people thought these things. I can tell you a little anecdote, which is that when I was about 14, I was at a boarding school, a sort of British boarding school. And we had a new chaplain. So the school had a sort of Episcopalian character to it, I suppose, and all the boys, it was a boys' school, had to go to chapel every day for a few minutes, about 10 minutes. Because we had to do it every day, we never took any notice of what was going on. It was like the wallpaper. Until this new chaplain pronounced the prayer that was said every morning in a new way. And it included the phrase, by the inspiration of thy Holy Spirit, which he pronounced inspiration. And I thought, oh, that's very interesting. I've just been reading about the Greeks who thought that the muses would breathe into them their poetry. So I went to see him and I said, this Christianity business, I said, give me something to read, because I was a very studious youth. And he gave me a very interesting reading list, which included Dostoevsky and the Epistle to the Romans, allegedly the great converting epistle, the Honest to God, a book by Bishop Robinson, which had a great success in the 1960s, of a sort of religion without God version. And I took these books and others home that holiday, read them very carefully. When I went back to school, I went to see him and I said, I've read everything you asked me to read and I have a question for you. And the question is, how can you believe this stuff? And he said, every morning when I wake, I pray the prayer of St. Augustine, which is, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. And I said to him, so you don't really believe it either. And I suspect this is true of many, many clergymen, really. And I said to him, look, I said, what really gets me about this is, here's the story, okay? God makes mortal maiden pregnant. She gives birth to this extraordinary character who, among other things, goes to the underworld, comes out again, and rejoins his father. This is a story I've heard dozens of times. It's commonplace in Greek mythology. Zeus, who had the wonderful existence of making mortal maidens pregnant all the time, and they would give birth to egregious characters like Hercules and others, who sometimes went to the underworld and came out and joined Zeus on Olympus. I said, this is a very, very common myth. So why is this one true and the others not? And he wasn't able to give me a decent answer to that, and I've never found anybody who's given me a decent answer to it, which is why it so powerfully reinforces the fact that what children who, for good evolutionary reasons, are credulous, are made to believe by the adults in their circle, can become so entrenched and seem to make so much sense that they can't question it or they can't see until somehow or other they're perhaps helped to. Very odd it is, or how very implausible and absurd it is.
I love that. My daughter is 8, and she reads at a higher level. She absolutely loves to read. And we had given her a lot of, she loves Greek mythology, especially, but she loves Egyptian as well and all the other mythologies. And we gave her all of those to read first. And then she finally asked me for a Bible last year. So I bought her a Bible from the used bookstore, because they're cheap. And and she sat down and she opened up Genesis and she was just disgusted because she had read all of this before in different mythologies. And she couldn't understand why anybody would think that Christianity specifically wasn't just a rehash of stuff that was much older.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's so true. My own youngest daughter, who's now 13, when she was 8, see, I'm bringing her up to be an atheist, which means that I'm bringing her up to be skeptical and critical and say to people, what's the evidence and what are the arguments and why do you think that? And, you know, does anybody disagree with you? And if they do, why do they? Do you know their arguments? They don't agree with you. So she said to me one, and also I say to her, don't use the word God as if it were a name. Use the phrase gods and goddesses. Because when you talk to people, if they ask you, do you believe in God? You say to them, do you believe in gods and goddesses? They'll say, well, no, I don't, but I believe in one. Then you say to them, well, why only one? If there were one, why couldn't there be more? And how do you know there's only one? And so on. And also I say to them, when you're in discussions with them, and they say things like, well, the universe was created by God, challenge them a bit. Say to them, will you, for the next 5 minutes, instead of using the word God, just use the name Fred, and then tell me all the things that you believe using the name Fred, and then see if it explains anything more clearly. Fred created the universe, or Fred says we mustn't tell lies. And then, of course, you see that the use of the word God is completely empty of any kind of explanatory power at all. So I get her to do this kind of thing, and she loves it. She's always challenging people, and she wears her little atheist badge on her lapel. But when she was 8, she said, Daddy, I don't believe in gods and goddesses, but I do believe in the tooth fairy. And I said, well, you have very good empirical evidence for that, because every time a tooth falls out of your head, you get a pound. So there's the empirical evidence. And I said, also, it happens to be true that there is a tooth fairy. The tooth fairy happens to be me, but at least there is something answering to the description of the tooth fairy. So in that kind of way, I thought the empirical upbringing was being successful.
So before we go, Asia, I do have one really critical question for you, which is, when you were at the Creation Museum, did you ride the dinosaur?
Do you know what? I really wanted to, but I didn't get an opportunity. But I really, really wanted to.
You were deprived.
If I'd had a Stetson with me, I would have moved. If people say heaven and earth to do it.
Yeah, you know what? It's true, though. If you don't have the cowboy hat, you really shouldn't ride the dino.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before you go today?
Only that my recent encounter with members of the Humanist Association in the States was, I thought, tremendously encouraging. I loved meeting them. And it was an eye-opener. I found it very educative, actually, because we know from this side of the pond some of the difficulties that people who are, you know, out atheists face. I was talking to somebody who is one and who was at risk of losing clients who might find out that he was one. I mean, that kind of thing, the sort of prejudice there is against people of that persuasion. I was very interested indeed in the way that the humanist community, the atheist community, the secularist community, the skeptical community keep their separate identities. I think in general that's not a bad thing. It's good to have lots of different voices from different angles coming at things. It makes a big difference in the public conversation, so that's good. Every now and then, of course, it's also good if they join together with a unified voice in order to get something done. And I know that that happens sometimes too, because I think the Reason Rally was the result of a lot of different organizations coming together in Washington. That was great. So I learned a lot. I hugely enjoyed it. And it was really wonderful to meet the humanist community in the U.S. Because as one always expects from humanists, what a lovely bunch of people they are.
Indeed. Well said. Well, Issei, thank you very much for being on the show. Thank you for your activism as well. And I look forward to meeting you in person someday.
I look forward to that as well. My very warm good wishes to you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was AC Grayling. You can learn more about AC at acgrayling, GRAYLING.com. And his new book, again, is The God Argument, The Case Against Religion and for Humanism, which you can get just about anywhere.
Like I said, y'all, I have it. I love it. Get it today.
In the world of humanism, we've got coming up something pretty important and big. We've got the American Humanist Association convention coming up. It's going to be May 30th to June 2nd in San Diego. We've got a lot of awesome speakers there, including Dan Savage, Richard Leakey, Katha Pollitt, Greta Christina, some dude named Dawkins, and Sean Carroll. So it's got, we've got a great, have you heard of this?
Dawkins.
I think the AW is pronounced as a U.
Okay. Yeah. Dawkins. Yeah. That sounds familiar.
Richard Dawkins.
I think he's French.
It'd be awesome if he had a French accent. Better. So maybe Richard Dawkins doing a speaking only in a French accent will appear in San Diego. Please check out the convention. And listeners, please, if you have anything you'd like to comment on, questions, you can reach us on our comment line, 202-618-1371. And you can check out previous episodes and show notes at thehumanisthour.org.
And we have some excellent news for two people. These two people won copies of A.C. Grayling's book, The God Argument, in the trivia contest that we had last week on the Humanist News Network. Those two winners are Torre Jackson and Marie Bradshaw. So congratulations, you two, for getting a copy of the book, which I happen to know is absolutely fabulous.
Awesome. Congratulations, folks. And congratulations, Kim. You have survived your first episode of The Humanist Hour. Thanks for joining us and co-hosting.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I feel like I've thrived. I feel better for having been here. I appreciate it.
Excellent. All right, listeners, thanks so much. And we will see you next month when our guest is a mystery.
Ooh.
All right, have a great month, folks.
Bye, y'all.